with the theme from Ghost and Mr. Chicken.
I wanted to play something spooky.
Spooky, scary.
Because of Halloween.
Mm.
Sutek Hexen.
Yeah.
Breed in me the darkness.
I thought maybe it was Sun, since you were complaining that that's who they should be using to score American Horror Story.
They should. They should. This is, you know.
You should press stop. It's bad
about
the tape to
do that. Halfway through that sidelong track, it gets real heavy and crushing and pulverizing and guitarish, but it starts with these, you know, Halloweeny pianos.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So why don't you explain what this is?
Linoleum Knife. Oh, what is Linoleum Knife?
Yes.
It is a podcast of the cinema.
You're back to cinema now.
Hosted by me, Dave White. I'm the film critic for Movies.com.
And I'm Alonzo Duraldi. I'm the film critic for TheWrap.com.
My co-host.
Yeah.
My protege.
Please.
My assistant.
I'm your pilot.
My technician.
Only in that I'm...
You're my producer. You're like Chris Lavoie because you play ABC when I don't want you to. And you're my producer. And I'm the star.
I believe you mean I'm the total god of you. I run this show. You're lucky to be tagging along. I'm the film critic for TheWrap.com and for What the Flick on YouTube. And a crazy amount of celebrity deaths.
Everybody
this week.
Died this week.
Everybody died. It's insane. Hal Needham.
Patrice Shiro died like 2 weeks ago.
Yeah, and we somehow missed
that.
We
didn't know it.
The director of Queen Margot and Those Who Love Me Can Take the Train.
Which, you know what? You should see Those Who Love Me Can Take the Train.
I've been meaning to see it for years.
It's so great. That's my DVD pick this week. Is it on DVD?
I believe. Well, it was at some point. I don't know if it still is.
I mean, I'm looking at Amazon right now.
So you are out the gate with a DVD recommendation. Look at you.
Those Who Love Me Can Take the DVD. And it, moment of truth. It is available.
Woo!
So often the things that I recommend
are far out of print.
Are far out of print.
Are only available in Region 8.
Those Who Love Me Can Take the Train is the name of the film.
Okay.
And it is from director Patrice
Shiro.
And he was great. And that movie is great from 1999, 2000, something like that.
Yeah. His biggest, probably most well-known film in this country is Queen Margot. He also directed opera. I think he did a very well-reviewed Ring cycle in the late 70s, apparently, that like played all over the world.
I didn't know about that.
Yeah, I didn't mean either until I read his obit. Hal Needham died, who was just honored by the Academy last year with a special Oscar.
Smokey and the Bandit.
Stuntman, who then went on to direct such classics as Smokey and the Bandit and the Cannonball Run.
Cannonball Run is the best.
He does a commentary on Cannonball Run on the DVD, which I've had for years
what
just for the commentary.
Like,
I need
what
to listen
do I
to
like
it.
Better? Do I like Those Who Love Me Can Take the Train or Cannonball Run better?
They could both be your DVD pick this week.
I think they might both be my DVD pick this week.
So
dueling DVD picks
there we go.
From me.
So we lost
two excellent films in their own right.
We lost Hal Needham. We lost the great Marcia Wallace. From the Bob Newhart show, and she was Mrs. Krabappel on The Simpsons, and a very saucy match game panelist, and did mismatch game for Dennis Hensley at least once, which was hysterically funny. And it turns out she's also the sales lady who sold Jan Brady the brown wig.
I remember that.
Yeah.
Now that you bring that up, that is true.
Yeah.
So look at what we've wasted just now. True.
So yeah, she's a TV legend, very very funny woman. Antonia Bird, who directed the controversial film Priest, as well as Ravenous and the Drew Barrymore vehicle Crazy Love, passed away this weekend from pancreatic cancer. And today we find out that Lou Reed died at the age of 71 after having had a liver transplant earlier this year. I'm trying to think, I mean, if he had a direct kind of film legacy, per se, but, I think he didn't, like, score anything, or he's not in anything, but, you know, he's Lou Reed. His influence
in the 90s,
permeated everything.
In the 90s, he had a very memorable contribution to the Trainspotting soundtrack.
Oh, that's true.
It was an old song, but it was
Perfect Day
made fresh.
Yes.
By that movie.
Yes, and
then it turned into A Christmas Carol by Susan Boyle.
Oh, that's right. God. And Mystery Science Theater 3000.
Let me tell you, the spaceship. Seen the video of Susan Boyle singing Perfect Day. It's very sweet.
It is, and
by the end of it, you're like, I like Susan Boyle singing Lou Reed songs. Mm-hmm. I'm okay with that.
Okay, wait. Put a pin in Susan Boyle. I want to come back to that in a second. I just want to say, in Mystery Science Theater 3000, the spaceship that Joel and later Mike and the bots were stranded on was referred to as the Satellite of Love, which is a Lou Reed reference.
Right.
Susan Boyle is in a movie that is coming out this year called The Christmas Candle.
I'm sorry, what?
She's in it. Yes, she's making her film debut.
TV movie?
Theatrical.
What?
British. What? It's a British film. No, hold on. Here's the thing, though. It's got all these amazing people, and I thought, oh, this sounds really cool. Unfortunately, it is being put out by a company that has something to do with Rick Santorum.
What?
He gave this press conference this week where he talked about how Satan controls the movie screens, and he was trying to...
Well,
to
basically, Satan does control.
Yes, and that's why they're so great. But to drum up business for this Christmas Candle movie, and I was like... Because I looked at the cast.
Rick Santorum is like an executive producer?
Yeah, or his company is putting that in Africa. And he's got a cast of people that I like. And I thought, oh my God, I would have totally gone to this movie. But now, I can't.
Sure you can. Look, I'm going to see Ender's Game this
week. Obviously, I'm not going to Ender's Game, and I don't think I'm going to Christmas Candle either.
And I don't want to hear it from anybody about Ender's Game, seriously. We're going to talk about it next week when it opens. And I will have reviewed it for movies.com. Mm-hmm. You will not have reviewed it for the rap. You are refusing to review it.
Because here's what
it comes to. Well, no, we're going to have this discussion next week.
Okay.
But
I will explain myself.
And I will explain myself.
I think I have a very good reason for
And I have a very good reason for doing.
Yeah.
We're going to talk about that next week. Look, I just did a teaser for next week.
Tune in next time.
Yeah.
So also in The Christmas Candle is Samantha Barks. From the terrible Les Mis movie.
The one that was nice.
Yes,
her. The nice girl.
Yes. Yeah. Leslie Manville.
Remind me who
she's in all the Mike Lee movies.
Oh, yes.
Susan Boyle is in it. John Hannah is in it.
All right.
From Four Weddings and a Funeral.
Yes.
There were several names upon it. I was like, okay,
actors
I like
just
people.
Like actors just like to work. They don't care.
Yeah, and I don't even know that this is necessarily like your typical, horrendous, Christian movie.
It's called The Christmas Candle.
Yeah, well, I'm sure it's
not going to be a good film.
I'm sure it's sweet and sentimental or whatever, but I don't know that the British do Christian-y miracle movies the way that Americans do.
I don't know. Like, I don't know what they do.
I'm going to go
that in England it is always a very secular Christmas.
I'm going to go out on a limb here and say this movie has a lighter touch than, say, anything that Kirk Cameron has ever been associated with.
Well, yes, obviously.
For instance.
Yeah. I mean, this is a perfect segue to a thing that we should be talking about.
Mm.
I'm in love with a church girl.
Yes, which you saw last week. We didn't get time to get to last time.
The
starring
in England, Christmas is much more secular than it is here. In fact, I'm gonna say I think they have a better time than we do. Like,
it's less about the Church of England and more about Tesco.
It's more about just having a blast. Like, everyone I know, anything I've ever seen about Christmas in the UK is that it's just a party.
Mm.
It's a party, and you are. And it's okay to yell Merry Christmas at people because they don't really have any sort of
religious underpinning
over there.
They have religion over there.
Well, nominally. I mean, just some people, not much. And the...
you're saying culturally they've managed to divorce it from its...
From religion.
From religion,
and
but still...
somehow have a really good time doing it. In fact, that might be the reason they have a very good time. It feels more euphoric. Their pop culture version of Christmas feels much happier and bouncier than ours.
So it's just one big Love Actually over there.
Kind of, it's what it looks like to me from this distance
right.
is how it looks.
Those Spice Girls ads for Tesco.
Those Spice Girls ads for Tesco were great. And you can see them on YouTube.
I'll try and dig them up and put them on our Facebook page.
But yes, speaking of the Kirk Cameron body of work.
Right.
I make a point of trying to go see all the Christian movies that come out.
Right.
I grew up in the evangelical church. And so I know it intimately. And I know...
You know the code words.
I know the code words. I know the language. And I know where it all, you know, comes from. And I know what people mean when they say certain things when they're trying to say something else.
Right.
And so these movies fascinate me because I feel like almost every one of them has almost nothing to do with Christianity as it should be practiced. and has everything to do...
Hey, explain what that means, as it should be practiced.
Well, all right. If you are a Christian, an evangelical Christian, and you don't want to watch Wise Blood, you have a problem. You know, if you haven't read, you know, Walker Percy's The Movie Goer or any other Walker Percy, mm-hmm. you have a problem.
C.S. Lewis is about as far as they want to go into the realm of, like,
yes,
intellectual
authorship. C.S. Lewis was primarily like a theologian mm-hmm. who wrote fiction. And I'm talking about artists who were also people of faith
right.
who created great works of art.
Who wrestle with the angels.
Who are willing to say and go places that Christian pop culture refuses to go. So what you then have in the end in terms of, you know, movies that come out are films like the cop movie that came out last year.
It's like Courageous.
Courageous, something like that. What a terrible, terrible movie that was. But it was all about, you know, establishing a version of Christianity that is incredibly personal and full of this sort of doublespeak that makes no logical sense to anyone outside of the group that already believes it.
Right.
So these movies affect no one outside of that circle of folks because it's all this coded language and it's all this very much, it's all this very sort of like intimate, personal, my relationship with Jesus kind of movie
right.
that becomes highly subjective and results in really boring movies like Courageous, really crazy movies like See Me Dance, mm-hmm. where you've got people who are psychic and doing battle with literal devils that show up in trench coats and kung fu you. It's such a great movie.
Oh, yeah.
Oh,
Let
Her See Me Dance. I talk about it every chance I get. Please, please, please go watch Let Her See. The C stands for cancer. Me Dance.
And it's a Christmas movie.
It's a Christmas movie. It is the most bananas, most insane, worst thing you will ever watch in your life. And you will not want to stop watching it. And you will want to watch it again immediately after you're done.
Well, I think that
so now on to I'm in love with the church.
Well, no, what I wanted to say real quick is I think that a lot of these movies can only muster a certain kind of drama because there can't ever be any sort of realistic conflict that would suggest that the hero suggests that the moral underpinning of the movie is up for discussion.
Right.
And correct. So that already cuts you off from any kind of discussion or conflict or
you cannot be artistically valuable unless you're willing to say that you might be wrong.
Right.
And your characters might be wrong.
Because otherwise you're just making propaganda.
If you won't say that, if you refuse to go there, then your movie has no value. Your story has no value.
Mm.
Because there's no conflict. There's surface, shallow conflict.
Right.
You know, will Ja Rule be good? Or will he not be good?
Right. It's all leading to the inevitable.
And Ja Rule stars in I'm in Love with a Church Girl, and he falls in love with a church girl. He's a drug dealer who lies to her at the beginning of the movie and says, no, I used to do that. When he's still actively doing it. Stephen Baldwin, dun, 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 and Michael Madsen, who will do anything. They are cop FBI guys investigating Ja Rule because he's such a kingpin. Mm-hmm. But they can't find anything on him because he really did give up drug dealing just like that. The minute he met the church girl, who is played by someone whose name I cannot remember. I've never seen her in anything else before, to my knowledge. And so he courts her, and increasingly dangerous things happen. Christian rappers, Toby Mac and...
Adrian Balon, is that her name?
Yeah.
Okay.
What's she been in?
Hang on.
Toby Mac is in it, and...
The Cheetah Girls.
Oh, she was one of the Cheetah Girls?
She was one of the Cheetah Girls. All right.
Well, that's why I didn't know
she was. And she's the oldest member of 3LW.
Oh, is she really?
Mm-hmm.
Hmm. Well, thanks, 3LW, for giving us a new addition to cinema.
And she was in Coach Carter.
Great. Anyway.
Go on.
Cheetah Girl. she's very nice. She's not going to tolerate having a drug dealer, though, for a husband. Future husband. He has to be godly.
Right.
He has to be born again.
Isn't her dad like a preacher or something?
Who?
The Cheetah Girl.
No.
Okay. No. I came in at the very end of this. No. Sorry.
I'm blanking on the name of the other Christian rapper in the movie, but it doesn't matter. And something like Bone Dog or somebody like that. There's this great scene. She works in a faith-based retail outlet in a mall. And he comes into the store.
T-Bone, I believe.
Yeah, okay, Bone Dog. And then she says to him, he walks in, he's like, what's this music? What's this great music I'm listening to? And she's like, you don't know Christian music? And he's like, no. And she's like, I'm going to hook you up with some hot Christian music. And I was like, then you're a magician, because there is no such thing as good Christian music.
Christian music is always the lower price spread. Like, when I lived in Dallas, I had the first apartment I had, our internal cable, the default channel was always ZTV, which was like the sort of all Christian MTV station.
Yes.
And so, and I would catch bits of videos every so often, and I would just think, okay, so you're supposed to be the Christian Wilson Phillips, mm-hmm. and you're supposed to be the Christian Pet Shop Boys, and yes. you're supposed to be the Christian Color Me Bad. Like, yes. it was so that, you know.
Yes. And again, I know what I'm talking about here. I'm not just talking here.
Yeah.
I grew up lived it. Listening to Christian pop in the 80s. Mm. I was there. And there are officially like three artists from that entire genre who ever meant or mattered anything.
Sam Phillips.
Sam Phillips and a couple other folks.
Second Book of Acts.
Second Chapter of Acts from the 70s. They were so great. But
are we counting the Free Design?
I don't think anyone... in that world counts the Free Design.
Mm-hmm.
Like, the Free Design were off on their own thing.
Because they said they have some Jesus-y songs.
They do, and they were, but they were never really...
doctrinaire enough.
Yeah. So, anyway, she winds up in a car accident because you need, again, some kind of external...
artificial conflict.
Conflict. Because there's no personal conflict going on at all, other than will Ja Rule be good
right.
for her? And, you know, he's given up his drug dealing, so he thinks that ought to be enough, like God ought to be on his side. But then, you know, God might kill his girlfriend. Cheetah Girl might die, so he goes to this church, this gigantic stained glass Jesus in the church, and he starts yelling at it.
And this is at the window?
At the window. He starts yelling at the window and having a confrontation with the window.
Mm-hmm. This is like Oogie Loves all of a
sudden. And says, you know, don't take her, take me. You want to send me to hell? Book the flight. And this is how the movie strives to be gritty and keep it real.
It's so street, yes.
By being street with the way you talk to Jesus.
Window.
Jesus window. And she wakes up from the coma.
Mm.
And then he really did give up drug dealing, and he becomes a preacher. and then that's it. It sucks. It is so boring. And here's the funniest thing of all. There were four other people in the theater with me when I saw it.
Yeah, I had more people at the Fifth Estate when I went.
Yeah. And there was a couple, like three rows in front of me that did nothing but shriek laughing through the entire film. And I kind of held it in. Like, I wasn't going, ha, ha, ha.
Right, right, right.
They were busting a gut and falling out over this movie. And here's the thing. I think they were the target audience for the film. I think they were like a Christian audience.
Oh, funny.
Because they seemed to be very into the Christian stuff, the messages of God that would come from the dialogue. Because every once in a while, like, the woman would be like, that's right. She'd talk to the screen. She'd be like, that's right. And I'd think, okay, you're affirming the Christianity of this film, and yet you are laughing at everything else.
Even you know this movie stinks.
Yeah, and so I read an article, a really great interview with Ja Rule this past week, where he just got out of prison, you know.
Oh, okay.
He was in prison for like 3 years for taxes.
Mm-hmm. And he found Jesus.
No, here's an interesting thing. He shot the movie before going to prison. Oh. It's been on the shelf for 3 years.
Wow, okay. Well, I guess when one of your executive producers is God, you don't have to worry about interest.
One of the executive producers in the credits is God, who could not be reached for comment on this matter. He says in the article, after using the F word like five times, that he was recently born again. And I think
so. He wasn't when he made the movie?
No! And then he goes to prison, and no! And then he talks to the New York Times and says the F word a bunch, and then says he's just been born again. I love this guy now. I can't wait to see what he says next. Like, it feels like he's saying anything he can to get anyone to go see the movie.
Which no one is.
And no one is. Because, you know why? Because there's no kung fuing the devil in it. That's why.
Mm.
If you were crazy in the head in, like, See Me Dance, then you would have a long run.
Yeah, that movie didn't do so hot either, unfortunately.
Well, that's not because I've tried. That's not because
I've. That for our lack
of
promoting.
That's not because
it.
I've been lax about promoting it.
I don't know. In my book, Have Yourself a Movie Little Christmas, I suggest if you have a really warped sense of humor and you want to see two terrible movies about young girls fighting cancer at Christmas time, who are dancers, you could do a 6 weeks See Me Dance double feature, but that's not for everyone.
Yeah. Or if you want to see a movie about people battling Satan at Christmas time, you would watch Santa Claus.
There you go.
And See Me Dance.
It fits into so many potential double bills.
I'm telling you, forget about I'm in Love with the Church Girl. Go rent
See Me Dance.
See Me Dance, Cannonball Run, and Those Who Love Me Can Take the Train.
Okay.
Those are my DVD picks of the week.
You are loading up. Now, there's one Christian movie that I saw the trailer for, and I was just sort of agog, and I need to see the movie, where it's basically about like three pregnant women who try to get abortions, and instead they basically get held prisoner by.
It's like a human centipede, but a pro-life human centipede.
Yeah, like being forced to go. And the doctor is the hero.
Yeah, I don't remember the name of the movie, but I do need to see that one too.
Yeah,
I'm just waiting for the day. Honestly, I am genuinely, sincerely waiting for the day when a good Christian film comes along. There hasn't been one literally since The Apostle. Robert Duvall.
But the I'm in Love with the Church Girl audience did
not
go
not
see.
Want to see The Apostle. No. Because that's the disturbing film.
Right.
But that's the kind, I mean, you want to keep it real, keep it real. You know, make a film like The Apostle.
I saw a trailer for another one about, it's basically set in a small town where, like, all the Christmas stuff is being taken down because, you know.
Oh, really? There's a war on Christmas movies?
Yes.
Wait, I've got to catch up.
I know. I'm waiting for the ex-gay one. You know there's got to be one in the pipeline.
I'm sure there's already one out there that we just don't know about.
Oh, I think we'd know.
Maybe.
Mm.
I don't know.
Moving on. The big release of the week is Jackass Presents Bad Grandpa.
And it's fine.
Yeah. It's not as much fun as the first three Jackass movies because somebody decided that they were going to have a plot, sort of.
Yeah.
And not even just as a plot, as a framework to hang gags on, but like Johnny Knoxville as the bad grandpa and this kid Jackson Nicholl, who was in Fun Size, stay in character even when they're the only ones in the scene. So,
and they have this very sort of tender bonding that's taking place.
Yeah.
If you go back to Borat, there was, you know...
Yeah, they stay in character.
They stay in character too, but it's always in the service of something crazy.
Yeah, so they can wrestle each other in the hotel room or whatever.
This is in the service of making you feel something.
Yeah, for it's these, this for weird this, dollop of sentimentality.
Yeah, this strangely sentimental, force-pushy kind of moving thing happening, where you're supposed to forget for a second that you're in on the joke.
Right.
That you know that this is Johnny Knoxville in old age makeup. And the kid also knows that it's Johnny Knoxville in old age makeup. And the kid knows that he is also an actor and that they're both actors and that they're pranking people. And then they start being grandpa and grandson with each other. And it's this bizarre shifting of gears. You know, you've got these funny pranks that are, you know, sub-jackass kind of stuff. Because no one's getting injured, really. There's only one stunt where Johnny Knoxville even could possibly be hurt. And that's when he's on the kiddie ride that goes through the plate glass window.
Right.
And,
yeah, this is more about, like, you know, hiring a choir to be at a funeral and then, you know, knocking the casket over and having the body fall out, you know.
They're pranking unsuspecting people.
Yeah, yeah, you know, like showing up at a wedding and falling into the table with a cake and a pyramid of champagne glasses.
And they're not doing it in the Borat way either. In Borat, they were specifically aiming to elicit the worst possible responses.
Like, they're trying to get people to expose their racism or their anti-Semitism or whatever.
You know, any kind of xenophobia. That was the intent of Borat.
Right.
The intent of Borat was, let's see how awful people really are when they're confronted with something that makes them really uncomfortable.
Yeah, this is more kind of hidden camera hijinks.
Yeah, and it's very much like, you know, America's Funniest Home Videos sort of level of stuff.
Yeah.
That's
funnier than that.
Funny. I mean, no, look, America's Funniest Home Videos is funny. That show hasn't been on for 700 years because it's not funny.
The only stuff I ever find funny from that show is when you see the bootleg tapes of the stuff that they didn't
well,
use.
It was
more jackass kind of stuff.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, I laughed a lot at this movie. I mean, I would recommend it, but it's if you are a Jackass fan, know that you're
recommended
not
on TV.
Really?
Yeah, okay. It's just okay. I mean,
I laughed a whole lot.
I laughed a whole lot too, but it's the definition of empty calories.
Well, there's sure.
Really
yeah.
Nothing. Jackass felt like a manifesto to me. Jackass felt like a declaration of, we are the bros who don't care about anything.
Right.
Except this intense camaraderie we have toward pushing each other to new extreme heights of lunacy.
Yeah.
It was definitely sort of, it had an agenda, whether it stated it or not. It was about guys having fun and being not uptight about stuff.
Right.
And this doesn't really have any sort of point.
No, it doesn't, you know, it doesn't sort of have that kind of, you know, what John Waters calls the sexual anarchy of Jackass. It doesn't have this sort of crazy theater
and you
of
can't
cruelty.
When you've got an 8-year-old kid in the, you know, mix.
Well, I mean, they use the kid in ways that I think a lot of people, that other people wouldn't, you know. I think they push it further. But even that kind of started reminding me of Wonder Chosen.
Yes.
You know.
Yes.
I mean, and like the big, like some of the big ideas in this movie feel like they're right out of Little Miss Sunshine, or again, Borat, or whatever. Right. But nonetheless, I had a good enough time that I'm not going to knock it for not being as cool as the first three Jackass.
I'm glad I saw it for free.
Really?
Yes.
Okay, wow.
I'm glad I saw it for free.
Well, I guess I liked it more.
I laughed, and it was because it cost me nothing.
Okay, well.
Yeah.
All right. Now, you saw
The Counselor.
The week's most controversial film, The Counselor. And it's especially controversial because you didn't hate it.
Well, I woke up Friday morning.
Right.
I had not yet read any reviews. I went to see it. They held the press screening on the same night.
As Bad Grandpa.
As Bad Grandpa. So, you know, I go. It's a big crowd. You know, the audience. And it's me and all these old people.
Well, you know, again, this is a movie that we didn't hear anything about until a couple of weeks ago, and it's directed by Ridley Scott.
Yep. It
features the first original screenplay by Cormac McCarthy.
Yep.
It stars Michael Fassbender and Javier Bardem and Penelope Cruz and Cameron Diaz and Brad Pitt.
And a host of character actors that
And Ruben Blades and all these, you know.
John Leguizamo.
You think this would be like a big year-end schmancy award season movie.
Yes.
And they snuck it out.
Yeah.
What was the joke? It wasn't released into theaters. It escaped. You know?
It is about Michael Fassbender as an attorney who everyone just calls counselor. Like, he doesn't have a name.
Right.
And he is, the movie opens and he's already in mid trouble. He doesn't know it yet. Drug deal that Javier Bardem, a nightclub owner, has sort of brokered, and Michael Fassbender is sort of a nominally corrupt kind of lawyer in South Texas.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he gets by, he's got a lot of money, but he's, you know, he's looking to make more money. He's a little greedy, wants to get in on something.
Mm-hmm.
It all goes wrong, and now everyone must be killed. Because this is like the cartels, you know, and you've got Cameron Diaz as Javier Bardem's girlfriend, and she, the opening scenes with her are the best, because she's got like a gold tooth off to the left, up top. You barely see little flashes of it every once in a while. It's not like she grins and shows it to you.
Right.
She's got these like fingernail polish that's silver, and it looks like her fingernails are made of silver. They're like hard, hard, hard.
Right.
She's riding a horse. She's got this sort of haltery thing on. You can see cheetah spots tattooed on her shoulder going down her back. And she has two pet cheetahs that she allows to chase other wild animals for sport while she's riding a horse next to them, watching them kill things. And you think to yourself as you're watching this, you're bad. And you will do something bad later to at least one person, if not many people.
Well, if you introduce a cheetah in Act 1, you know.
You're going to fire it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And if you introduce a cheetah girl, then she's going to go into a coma.
Exactly. And so then you learn that Javier Bardem is sort of terrified of her because she had sex with his car.
Okay.
I can't even describe the way she does it or how they talk about it in the film, because it would make this podcast unclean.
Here's my understanding from what I've read about this.
She gets down with the car.
It involves her sitting on the windshield.
Yes.
And
yes.
Not wearing underwear.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. And so then, you know, Brad Pitt shows up and he's sort of like this laid back kind of cowboy guy in a suit and long and stringy hair. And you don't really know why he's there. Bad things are coming, and you can feel it, and you know it, and the movie feels an inevitable feeling from the very beginning. And then bad things happen, but as bad things are happening, for reasons that often remain unclear, and characters do things for reasons that often remain unclear, Rosie Perez shows up. Yeah.
Everybody whose name ends in a Z or a vowel.
They are all talking and talking and talking in this slow-moving, creeping, unthrilling thriller in quotes about the nature of morality and good and evil and chaos and order and life and death and who should live and who should die and, you know, what is the meaning of it all? And the answer is, you're all going to die and it's meaningless. That's so great. This movie, after I got home and I wrote my review, I started reading the other reviews, and everyone hates this film except me and our buddy Manola Dargis, who said in her review that it appears as though Cormac McCarthy, you know, Pulitzer Prize winning novelist, has never read a screenwriting book, how to write a screenplay book in his life. And it shows, and that's good.
Rene Ramirez of the Miami Herald, I think, also liked it.
And it's weird and slow, and sometimes it feels like it's bored with itself, and it's confusing at times, and it feels hopeless and empty and sad. And I liked it. Like, it's such a strange movie that I think everyone who goes to see it will most likely hate. If you decide you're going to go see
it, I might go with you again. After reading Andrew O'Hare at Salon calling it the worst movie ever. Oh, man,
his review is great. The headline in his review is, "Welcome to the worst film ever made."
I might have to check it out now. One critic that we know, I won't mention it because he just told me this in a text, said that he thought that the movie, that part of what was going on there was Ridley Scott's unresolved feelings about his brother's suicide.
There may be something about that. There may be something to that. I think it is a movie that in time will read differently than it does now. It's weird. Go see it. It's just a strange film.
Okay.
Very strange movie. If you go and I can, I might just go with you again. Because, it's interesting to look at.
And it might help that I'm going in knowing what I'm getting as opposed to people thinking, it's a major release and all these big stars are in it.
Right.
So
I walked in thinking I was going to get a sort of, a drug crime thriller.
Right.
And all the things that come with that.
Right.
And none of the things that come with that are really here.
You thought you were getting Carlito's Way or something.
Something more like that. Yeah. No.
Okay. Now,
can we put off Blue is the Warmest Color until I see it?
Yeah. Okay. We'll wait. That open this week. In the meantime, I reviewed Blue is the Warmest Color on What the Flick. You can find that on YouTube.
And the other thing that you have seen that I have not and I promise I will to the screenwriter and director who I know.
Kill Your Darlings, which Dave hasn't seen yet, but I just did a Q&A last night at the Arclight with John Krukitis, who directed it. It's his first film. I like this movie a lot. I saw it at Sundance, and it stars Daniel Radcliffe as the young Allen Ginsberg, very young, going off to Columbia University as a freshman and trying to figure out, what he wants to do with his life and excited about the opportunities of getting out of New Jersey and away from his crazy mother, played by Jennifer Jason Leigh. He immediately falls into the orbit of the very charismatic Lucien Carr, played by Dane DeHaan, who introduces him to bebop music and Harlem and drugs and alcohol and William Burroughs and Jack Kerouac.
Great things.
Yeah, and this is a true story. And it turns out then there is a murder that happens. And it's this sort of fascinating little footnote of literary history that I did not know. I'd never heard this story before. I think it's a really compelling film. I think it's hard to make a movie about writers because writing is so uncinematic.
Mm-hmm.
But I think they get around that pretty well. The performances are all terrific. Dane DeHaan, this guy is...
He's gonna be something.
He's going to be something. Yeah. I mean, it's like this is... I remember seeing...
Unless, of course, he doesn't.
Right. But my feeling about him now is the way I felt about Leonardo DiCaprio, say, post-Gilbert Grape.
Yeah.
Where I was like, this guy has got the stuff.
Right.
And it's funny, talk about, mixed reviews. This movie's got mostly positive reviews, but I think a lot of the people that don't like it kind of knock it for its sort of, the sort of wide-eyed idealism of the characters. I have a theory about that. I think that film critics are perfectly happy to cop to things like, I played Dungeons and Dragons in high school or, stuff like that that's sort of nerdy.
Yeah.
But I don't think people are as willing to admit to the fact that when you are 18 and you go to college, that sometimes, you get these big, bright notions about changing the world and about literature and about, you meet these really sort of seductive, charismatic people who seem like, who totally rock your world, and then maybe later you find out that there's less to them than meets the eye. But, that first flush of like, whoa, you're amazing, I think that this movie captures that really well, and that feeling and that exuberance. And I think that makes some people uncomfortable that they ever experience it themselves and they don't want to cop to it.
Well, yeah.
So I mean,
I never did.
Of course, yes.
I was born sophisticated.
Yes, you came out of the womb with a monocle and a cigarette holder.
I do not smoke.
I think it's a really wonderful film. For a super low budget movie, they get the period detail really good. They get it really right. I think Daniel Radcliffe's amazing in this. And, yes, he has a gay sex scene in it, which is sort of the go-to talking point for people, and it's perfectly fine.
Right.
But there's a lot more to his performance. Yeah, I recommend this movie very highly. I think it's terrific. It opened a little wider this weekend. It's still sort of making its way around the country, but check it out. It's a terrific movie. I like it.
Okay, so we covered one Christian movie and one gayish movie.
Mm-hmm.
And now we're going to cover two documentaries that are Christian and gayish.
Oh, that's true. Well, then it'd be gayish.
And both are complete bummers.
Yeah.
Absolute and total bummers.
In different ways. What do you want to start with?
God Loves Uganda.
Yes, which is also in limited release right now.
It is about how American conservative evangelical missionaries are going to Uganda. And I'm going to give them this. They're doing some good things. They're building things.
Right.
They're building schools. They're bringing health care. They're bringing nutritional programs. They're doing good things.
With that, however,
comes an insane level of anti-gay proselytizing,
which is making its way into actual law.
Which has in turn become bizarre laws in which if you are considered to be gay, they can sentence you to prison or death. This is obviously a bit of a problem.
Yeah.
What's
really cool about this movie, in addition to, I found it sort of darkly funny at times, just because the young missionaries are so bright-eyed and ignorant of the whole of the world, especially Africa. But the fact that you see these idiot Americans who clearly, like, they realize the message is not landing over here anymore, except among an ever-shrinking population of lunatics. So they take it abroad.
They don't start out as lunatics. They're merely uneducated.
Right.
Then they become lunatics.
But what's great is that the heroes of this film are also Ugandan. And they're also religious.
Yes.
You know, so the movie isn't out to slam the church. The two people who are really doing the most to sort of counteract this anti-gay stuff
are two ministers.
And they themselves risk everything from
one of them still lives in Uganda.
Yeah,
how he hasn't been murdered.
Yeah, the other one had to flee to Boston because they were threatening his life. But they're both threatened with excommunication from their own church.
Yes.
I mean, it's like
were excommunicated.
Yeah, so it's a very unpopular stance, but they are fighting the good fight, and good on them for it. It's kind of a bummer, but not entirely.
Entirely a bummer. It is entirely a bummer, and one of the ministers who is pro gay. He had a very interesting thing to say about the young missionaries, the 18, 19, 20-year-old missionaries, who are like, they're coming here because they want to have an adventure.
Right.
And they don't understand the consequences of what they will leave behind.
Mm.
He goes, you bring these ideas here, and what you are doing is depositing them into the hands of people who will simply take the law into their own hands and deliver justice however they see fit.
Right.
And that is,
And then you end up with the De Ita Pupu guy.
Then you got a Martin Sempa who's a genuine lunatic.
Yeah.
And or a complete charlatan.
Right.
And I'm beginning to think he's actually more of a charlatan because I follow his Twitter feed. And he says the most sort of baiting, like, taunting things on Twitter, and I think, you know what? You're either one thing or the other. You either are filled with Christ's love,
mm-hmm.
and you're doing your best to help people, or you're intentionally picking fights.
Or you're just a troll.
Because you're a troll and a jerk and a bully who's out to make some money. And I'm beginning to just think that that's what he is.
Well, one of the things I find interesting about the film also is that, you talk about the missionaries bringing...
Because, that whole eat the poo-poo thing?
Yeah.
He shows his church gay S&M shisa porn. Shows it to them. You see him showing it to them. And any reasonable thinking person is going to go,
ew.
Yeah. And he presents it to his church as, well, this is what
all of
gays
them
do. It is the single funniest, nastiest thing in the film. And the most reprehensible at the same time. Yeah.
So
watch this movie. Watch God Loves Uganda.
It's really
you want to really feel bad about everything.
I felt like the movie has some hope to it. It wasn't like a movie like Valentine Road that was just where right. you're just really sad at the right. end. This one, I thought at least there was some people fighting the good fight.
It's an okay made documentary. I mean, it's like not a badly made documentary.
No, I think it's very done. Yeah. You talk about the missionaries bringing over the sanitation or the buildings or whatever.
Yes.
But you've also got the guy there who is now running his own version of a mega church who yes. lives in this crazy opulent mansion.
Yes.
You know, it's like, oh great,
one of the five richest men in Uganda. I looked him up after watching the film.
It's like, oh no, keep helping. This is what Jesus would want.
Yes,
for you to have this insane mansion in a country that is racked by poverty.
Right,
great.
Where the roads aren't even paved.
Exactly. You know? The other documentary we were talking about this week is Bridegroom, which actually premieres tonight as we're taping this, October 27th, on Oprah's network on OWN, and I'm sure they'll be rerunning it. So if you get to it late, you'll probably have a chance to see it. It's the directorial debut of Linda Bloodworth Thomason, who created Designing Women and did The Man from Hope. You know, she did all the Bill Clinton films from the Constitution, from the conventions. This project began life as a viral YouTube video.
Yes,
this guy named Shane Bitney Crone
It Could Happen to You.
And it was basically the story about how his longtime partner died suddenly in an accident, and the partner's parents basically shut him out of everything. They didn't let him come to the funeral. They took the body away and had him buried in Kansas, wherever he's from. And, you know, it makes somewhere in the Midwest. It makes a very salient point about what's at stake when we talk about gay marriages and about legal protection for same-sex couples.
Yes.
And so this is the movie, kind of takes the YouTube video as sort of a jumping-off point and tells more of their story and more about, you know, what's happened since then. It's
not good. It is a bad film. It is a bad film. This has nothing to do with the emotional content of the film.
Yeah.
I'm talking about it is a bad film.
It is an agenda-driven movie, to be sure. And I think it plays its hand a little rough at times, but it, you know, I've sat through that movie with full audiences of weeping people.
I know. So I understand that.
I think I put
myself in their shoes while watching the movie. I'm serious. I sat there watching it thinking to myself, of course, if you fell off a roof after I pushed you, I would be devastated.
Right.
I don't know what I would lose my mind. You know what I mean? Like, if you died suddenly because of some crazy random freak accident, I would be lost. You know, I mean, that's true.
And if it were compounded by the fact that
it felt horrifying to me to watch that happen, and if it were compounded by the fact that, you know, your family suddenly decided to shut me out.
Mm-hmm. Which they would not do.
I would lose my mind. Well, first of all, they wouldn't be allowed to because we're legally married.
True.
And secondly, they're great. Everybody in your family is awesome. And they like me better than you.
I know, it's true. I've resigned myself to that fact.
However, having said all that, and my empathy, sympathy, all of that, for the subject matter, and it is emotionally affecting subject matter, because you cannot distance yourself. If you are gay, you cannot distance yourself from it.
Right.
Because it could have happened to you. It's the luck of being married, it's the luck of being in California.
Sure.
That we have right now. If we were in Nevada, we would not have this protection.
Right.
If we lived 5 hours away from here, we would not have that protection.
Right.
If we lived in Texas, we would not have that protection. And so I get it. It's an important subject. It is a badly made film. Well, they spend the first 45 minutes making the case for these two guys' humanity.
Yeah.
When the day comes that we don't have to have a documentary that spends the first 45 minutes pleading with the audience to look at these two people as human beings, we will have accomplished something.
Well, I think it's telling that her filmmaking background includes those Bill Clinton bios.
Yes.
This is more a commercial for the humanity of queer people than it is almost for anything else.
Yes.
Let me ask you this. If through some crazy Clockwork Orange thing, you know, where they were tied to a chair with their eyes bolted open.
Yes.
If you showed this to people you know who are still
in the church
and who have...
And I know a lot of them.
Yeah, and who have made their displeasure with, you know, your lifestyle choices very clear and apparent to you. Would this win
them? For example, my best friend from high school, who is now a Baptist minister.
Okay.
Yes. Who's in the Southern Baptist Convention.
Mm.
Goes to those conventions.
Right, right.
I've known him since I was 13 years old.
Can this movie win hearts and minds?
Is no.
the question. Because you think they're past winning or what?
It can. I'm making that up. It can. This movie can win hearts and minds.
But
here's the thing. Mm-hmm. It can only win the hearts and minds of really unsophisticated people.
Some would argue that that's who's... And those are the ones that need winning.
I know. I just wish that the world were different and people were smarter.
Well, yeah.
Because it comes down to that. No. It's God Loves Uganda, and this film comes down to people just being stupid.
No, I agree.
It comes down to people not being thoughtful or reflective or searching on any level of their lives.
Right, but if those people exist, shouldn't things be aimed at them if we want to win them over?
Okay, sure, fine.
I mean, what's the point in overestimating them if they aren't going to hold up their end? You know what I'm saying?
I don't know. I don't have an answer. I spent my time growing up, like, questioning things and reading books.
I understand
that. I just don't have a lot of patience with people who won't do that
for
themselves.
You know, I think, again, this is the thing where if you want to win those people over, you have to win them over with something that... Because I watched this movie for Outfest, and I remember thinking, okay, this movie is not for me. It's not even necessarily for the Outfest audience, but I think that there is an audience that's going to... I mean, the Outfest audience loved it. They gave it the audience award, but I'm saying... this movie is designed for people who have to be walked through this material, who have to have it explained to them that we are indeed human beings.
I don't really have patience for walking anybody through anything anymore.
Okay.
That's someone else's job.
Okay, now. And then someone else is this filmmaker who
right,
did it.
Great.
So I'm not
it's still a bad film.
I'm not saying that you have to love this movie, but I'm saying don't you agree that it is effective at reaching that audience even if you don't feel like feel like reaching that audience.
I agree with you.
Okay, that's all I'm saying.
It's still a bad film, and
I think I think it's effective for what it sets out to
do. My point here, I'm going to turn 50 next year. You ain't down for me. I'm done. I'm not interested in holding your hand through it.
I understand that.
You should have been thinking things much more deeply earlier in your life.
But I think for people who have more patience, if they want to make a film like this that it will, you know, spoon feed these people to come around, then, you know, I think the movie is effective on that level.
Sure.
That's all I'm saying. I agree with you that, yes, for us it's ham-fisted. But for people who need to have it explained to them, the movie explains it pretty well.
Okay.
It's like how Logo wasn't for us.
Here's the thing.
Logo was for gay people who lived in the middle of nowhere who don't have access to stuff.
Let's say you spoon-feed somebody.
Uh-huh.
And they suddenly... Okay. Tomorrow we show this movie to my best friend from high school.
Uh-huh.
And he says... Oh, Dave, I guess, you know, I was wrong this whole time. You really are a human being just like me. Because that's the level they're going to come in at, okay?
That's a start.
And then what do I have to do for the next 50 years of my life? Keep holding his hand and teach him every damn thing he should already know and thought out for himself and answering every idiotic question. I've already done that with a couple of my friends, and they're lucky I stuck with them, honestly.
Oh, my God. So you would rather let this guy wallow in his own ignorance than go through the effort of...
He's got a brain.
...of the lengthy process of unlearning homophobia.
He's got his own brain. He can get there himself.
Okay, look, now you're just being lazy.
I'm not being lazy. I've worked hard, and so have you, and it's their turn to do the hard work.
Well, fine, but if the hard work starts with them watching this movie,
fine.
Then great.
But don't expect me to be their tutor when they're done watching the movie.
No one's asking you to do that. But homos. You know, look, this is we're a country that is perpetually having to
done.
We are perpetually having to unlearn things like racism and sexism and stuff. So homophobia is going to be the same way. It's like that 12 Days Not a Slave sketch on Saturday Night Live, where it's been 2 weeks since the...
Did you notice the audience sort of being nervous and not really laughing all that much at that sketch?
Oh, I didn't notice. No.
Yeah.
You know, I think this is an ongoing process, and not everybody is going to hop in at the level that you want them to hop in at. Mm-hmm. And we need to have something that will accommodate those morons until they get their act together.
I'm done with morons.
Well,
that's it.
Fine, but
someone else can babysit.
Okay, and that someone else is Linda Bloodworth Arnson. So I think she deserves props for what she's doing, even though
you deserve props, Linda
Bloodworth
Thomason.
Even though
creator of Designing Women,
you and I see through what this thing is.
Did she write that part where Dixie Carter did the night the lights went out in Georgia?
I don't know.
If she wrote that, then that's pretty good.
She wrote a lot of stuff like that.
That's the one episode of Designing Women I ever saw. And the reason I saw it is because they used to play that clip in the gay bars in Dallas. Yes. In between, like the country gay bar.
Right.
In Dallas.
In between Reba videos.
They would even play it at the disco, like the Village Station. They would stop the dancing and play the Dixie Carter thing from the night the lights went out in Georgia. That was weird. That was back in Texas back in the day.
Yes.
Yeah.
So I think this is a movie that I'm sure probably is under the sophistication level of a lot of people that listen to this show, but maybe for a lot of people who listen to the show, they have friends or relatives they want to foist it upon.
Yeah.
So.
Foist.
Foist.
So I've done my DVD picks, all three of them.
Yes, you have. Well, mine is, I'm just doing one. Mine is Howl, which I may have done as a pick before, but I'm doing it again.
I think you did.
But it's worth it just because it's another great movie about Allen Ginsberg, this time played by James Franco.
I would say it's great, but it's
I think it's pretty terrific because it cuts back and forth between biographical.
I'm not bored with you
I
yet.
Hate it when you yawn when
I know, talking. I know. It was an accident.
So rude.
It was an accident.
You know, it's partially biographical about Ginsberg, specifically focusing on the obscenity trial that popped up after the publication of Howl. But it's also an attempt to visualize the poem, which is something that I haven't really seen a lot of movies try to do about poetry in general. And it's a risky move that I think totally works. It's directed by Rob Epstein and Jeffrey Friedman, who are some of the finest documentary filmmakers of this generation. They did the Times of Harvey Milk. They did The Celluloid Closet and Common Threads and Paragraph 175. And I think this is a really compelling film and did not get a huge reception in theaters, but I'm hoping people are discovering it. I think it's actually still streaming on Netflix, so if that's the case, I'll post a link on our page and stuff. The mailbag is empty.
No, it's not.
Almost empty.
Well, here's the thing.
No one has sent us a list in ages.
Well, yeah, we haven't gotten a list in a while, but we did get responses to last week's show.
Oh, yeah, true. We got some Facebook comments from people
We got Facebook comments and we got an email about apparently last week. Hey, Jack Morrissey, are you listening to this episode? According to listeners, you are responsible for the worst episode we've ever done.
But other people thought it was really compelling. it was across the board.
More than one person,
yes,
has expressed displeasure with last week's episode.
Specifically
with our pal Jack.
Well, specifically over...
And specifically with his insistence on not going to see
12 Years a Slave.
I don't know what to say to that other than the views expressed by our guests are not that of the Linoleum Night Podcast. And... not ours either, right. Of course.
I will say this. You and I see most of the movies that open because it's our job.
Yes.
And it's what we do for a living.
Yes.
I defend anyone's right to not go to a movie that they don't think they are interested in seeing for whatever reasons they cite. And it may be that it came out wrong or that it sounded... I don't know. Jack can speak for himself. I'm not going to try and interpret what he said or what was behind it. But I think ultimately,
he said was he won't go see 12 Years a Slave because it has nothing to do with his life.
Right.
That is obviously not my film going philosophy. I go see everything. And even if it weren't my job, I would still go see pretty much most everything.
Yeah, me too.
I do think that his statement about this has nothing to do with my life is actually sort of bluntly, honestly, the way most people engage with films. They go to things that they think will
make reinforce them, their own worldview?
No. Not necessarily that. Okay. But that will make them feel the way they feel like feeling after they leave. Hmm. And I think that people go to the movies for a variety of reasons, but predominantly people do go to the movies to be entertained. And if you feel as though a film is going to be hard work,
right,
or not interesting to you, or, you know, even possibly, you know,
punishing
in some way, whether it's, you know, just the violence in a film or
intellectually,
you
know, challenging,
making you feel like you're guilty of something. I think there was a mention of that in the... I'd have to go back and re-listen to what he said. But people do go to the movies that way. They pick what they want to see, and they have a variety of reasons and motivations for seeing or not seeing things.
Sure.
He's not going to see 12 Years a Slave because he doesn't think it has anything to do with him. And I think that specifically he goofed and said, I'm not responsible for slavery. And then you and I, after the show, had a very interesting discussion about, you know, do white people still benefit from slavery? And I say yes, that white people do still benefit from slavery because it only ended like 150 years ago.
True.
And like Louis C.K. said on The Tonight Show or whenever he was, that's only two 75-year-old ladies' lives back to back.
Right.
It's not like it was a million years ago.
No, and if you look at
the structures that were put into place because of slavery, the racism that became so part of the fabric of American life, that has not, it's not even like slavery ended and 12 Days Not a Slave took over and everyone was like, hey, black person who was a slave, let's be buddies. It was actually another 100 years of garbage before black people could say, oh, now things might actually start to get good for us.
And you can look at things like incarceration rates and stuff.
You can look at a whole lot of things.
Yeah, the obviously this is a country that still is
fighting
that battle. Yes.
So anyway, you and I had that discussion after the fact. Mm-hmm. We did not have it on the air because, you know, we like to keep it light. And so someday I would like to have Jack back on the show.
Yes.
Listeners, we will warn you when that's going to happen.
And to be fair, there were lots of folks who loved having him on the show. Thought it was an interesting discussion.
And so we're pro Jack. And
we're team Jack.
We're also pro anybody who hates him.
We like to mix it up.
But I think, you know, there's a sort of an honor to being a part of what many people have called the worst episode we've ever done.
And again, which other people said was one of our better ones. So
the what else? I guess that's it.
Okay.
We're done.
All right. As always, we thank you for listening.
Listen to Team Jack.
Listen to Team Jack.
When he ever does another one.
Yes. Go back and listen to our episode, if not. Check out The Comedy Couch with Dennis Hensley and Tony Tripoli. Check out Rotten Tomatoes Radio on Sirius XM. Also, check out Frank and Doria on OutQ FM. Sirius OutQ. Sorry, not XM. FM. XM, not FM.
You're the worst.
Shush. Check out the Frank DeCaro Show, and check out Derek and Romaine on SiriusXM. We are going back on Derek and Romaine in the next.
We are.
Yeah.
When
we got an email.
Oh, we did.
Yeah. Hang on. Let me see if we got the date. Check out Team Jack. Check out Throwing Shade and the B Movies Podcast and Film Spotting SVU. Pod Crash with that Chris Gore. Game Night Guys. Secretly Timid and The Lunch. You can subscribe to the show for free on iTunes, and please leave us a review when you're there. That helps us a lot. Oh, November 8th, Friday, November 8th, we will be on Derek and Romaine, so tune in for that.
Great.
You can stream this program at Stitcher Radio or thelounge.com. Like our Facebook page, Linoleum Knife Podcast. You can follow us on Twitter, at LinoleumCast.
Ooh, you know what else?
What?
Say your thing and I'll say.
Okay, you can check into the show at getglue.com. And of course, drop us a line with your thoughts, your comments, your top tens, your bottom tens, anything at linoleumpodcast@gmail.com. We love hearing from you and we will more than likely read your letter on the air if it's interesting.
Also, this past Friday night on KCRW in Los Angeles, yeah. The NPR station in Los Angeles, the show Unfictional that I am sometimes on, aired my segment from the live show.
You may recall Dave talking about how nervous he was about doing the live show.
Because it was me and all famous people.
Yes.
Like, on my episode that is now, it aired on the radio Friday night, but now it's streaming on the KCRW site.
KCRW.com/unfictional.
Something like that.
Yeah.
Yeah. If you type in KCRW and unfictional into Google, it'll bring it right up.
Yeah.
Or if you go to my Facebook page, I'm linking it pretty much every day this week.
Oh, and
I'm kind of proud of myself.
And I put it on the Linoleum Knife page, yeah, too.
I'm kind of proud of myself. Like, I didn't know
you did real well.
I didn't know that I had done all that well on the night. I was like, oh, I guess I didn't suck. I don't know. But then I heard it Friday night, and I was like, I kind of knocked it out. Like, I'm kind of happy with myself. I'm feeling me about this.
Yes.
So it was me on this episode. This is what's so wonderful, frankly, for me. They put me on the episode with Susan Orlean, who wrote The Orchid Thief, mm-hmm, which was turned into the movie adaptation.
And she's a New Yorker writer.
Starring Meryl Streep.
As Susan Orlean.
And Tig Notaro, who's, you know, yeah, the hot, hot, hot thing right now in the land of comedy. So it's me and those two ladies, and I am not worthy, honestly, to be next to them, but I sure am glad I am next to them on this episode. So y'all go listen to me and leave a nice comment on KCRW about me.
Yes.
Because my boss loves that stuff.
We want more of that Dave White guy. He's terrific.
So yeah, we'll link this up again on the Facebook page.
Sure.
And on linoleumknife.com, linoleum-knife.com.
The website. Have you put it there yet?
The website, no, but I will. The website that you should be visiting each day.
We're going to get better about more new...
No, we've already gotten better. I've been good this week because of you doing your Sundance Film Festival work.
Right.
And I've been carrying all the weight
on
my mule back.
Well done, sir.
Yeah.
So yeah, as always, we thank you for listening, and we will catch you next week when we will be talking about Blue is the Warmest Color.
Yes.
And you teased something.
I forgot.
You're not good at this.
I don't know.
We'll see you next time.
Goodbye.